Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Analytive Podcast. Today, I have a really special guest, Joe Fiormonte, revisits. Joe is a bit of an autodidact. He is a professor. He runs a design and branding firm. We've had him on, and we had a really deep dive about branding. So the origin of this conversation actually started with a post that I made on LinkedIn a couple months ago. I was in a conversation with one of our neighbor kids who's in high school. I think he's a junior in high school. And I was asking him about whether or not they're using AI tools and ChatGPT in their work. And he said, no, they're not allowed to use it at all because it's considered plagiarism. They would get in big trouble if they used any of these tools, which led me to make a post that, frankly, that was really concerning, right? Because this is one of, certainly when it comes to producing content, one of the biggest changes that we've seen over the past 2-3 years. And anybody who's not at least getting familiar with it, especially at the high school level, you know, elementary school, maybe it doesn't matter, but at the high school level, I think there's a missed opportunity there. So Joe reached out to me, he saw that post, and he's like, hey, we should talk about this. And so I'm calling this episode The Optimistic Case for AI, and we talk about really how changing technology generally can make things better, and it brings a ton of opportunity with it. We look at some historical examples, and we just riff on this idea of, you know, is AI a bad thing? Is AI a good thing? And by AI, we mean LLMs or generative AI, which is what we're seeing right now. And we just do a deep dive on that. So if you're kind of tired of the doom and gloom of the news cycle right now and you want maybe an optimistic view of what the future might look like and how AI gets incorporated, then this episode is for you. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Joe on the Analytive Podcast. Joe, thanks for coming back on the Analytive Podcast. So today we have an interesting topic, right? We're going to talk about AI, artificial intelligence, specifically like generative artificial intelligence, the ability of like ChatGPT, Midjourney, some of these tools to create things. We had chatted about this kind of on LinkedIn, exchanged a few texts about it, and you have some unique perspectives. And so I think we're going to call this the optimistic case for AI, especially from a job perspective and from a productivity perspective. And so yeah, so kicking that off, we know a little bit about your bio. We already read that. So just take us right into the deep end here. Like, what is the optimistic case that you're seeing? Because you work in both academia and as a consultant and a designer. What's the optimistic case for this as we move forward here in the next, you know, months to years?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks so much for having me back. I always enjoy the conversation. And this is a topic I'm really, I don't know if passionate is the right word, but really excited about. So yeah, maybe passionate is the right word. But I think, you know, AI is going to be one of the best things that has happened to humanity. I think it could also potentially, depending on how we choose to use it in the short term, be really scary and could bring about some tragedy. So I'm not that Pollyannish that, you know, I don't see some of the cons, but I think long-term there's a good historical precedent for technological paradigm shifts of this nature for thousands of years to be very, very optimistic. And I think it's really important that people are attentive to what's happening, especially educators, right? Because we are responsible for training up the next generation of designers and thinkers and writers and politicians and whatever it may be, to live in this world that is emerging because of this technology.
Yeah. So take us through the historical examples, right? Because I know you came prepared with a few of those. So I'm always curious, yeah. Like when we look at history, we look at technological progress over, you know, timelines, like take us through some of that.
Yeah. So I am not a historian, but I do teach the history of design at the college level, and I have for years, and I've kind of made a point of doing a deep dive. So I don't feel qualified, but I do feel knowledgeable. And there's kind of a pattern that I see, you know, there's some kind of a paradigm shift, some kind of new invention, right? And I think the printing press is a great example and one that's probably cited often. And it's met with a mixed reception of excitement and trepidation. Like certain people are a little uneasy of this for different reasons. And printing press is an example, I think a good in kind of a cautionary tale. It led to a lot of great things. It increased literacy. It led to the rise of universities. It's at least in part, you know, depending on which historian you're looking at, maybe large part responsible for the Renaissance that kind of preceded it. But you know, it also gave us the Protestant Reformation, which I look at it almost like World War Beta. Gutenberg, Martin Luther was very kind of savvy about printing, and so when he posted his 95 theses and kind of poked the eye of the Roman Catholic Church, the power broker of Europe at the time, he you know, that had happened plenty of times before, but he was privy to printing and he had those things circulated en masse. And it really led to like a bloodbath. It was not just a theological difference of opinion. There were wars fought for decades. Sure. That wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for that technology. And so, you know, the transitions in these paradigm shifts are often difficult, very often violent. That's just one example. But on the other side of those, life expectancy goes up. Democratization of wealth goes up. Education goes up. Infant mortality rates go down. Every metric we use to measure quality of life as human beings goes up. Industrialization, same story. Probably about the same timeline. And we get into the 20th century and we just have science and medicine like nobody had dreamed of, life expectancies that, you know, historically just didn't happen before. And I think AI offers us a lot of the same things and presents us with a lot of the same problems. I don't know, it's a little too abstract or not, but
Well, I think let's dive into that. So
okay.
The Reformation, right? So I'm familiar with it. Maybe our audience is, maybe it isn't, right? So the split from, you know, the Catholic Church. So I think, you know, we let off with the optimistic case, but there also is a bit of a transition point. So talk about like the inflection point there. Again, like how do you see, there's so many threads to pull on this. Like what does the inflection point sort of look like? So in other words, I think you're saying it's optimistic in the long run, but there's some speed bumps on the road. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yeah, I mean, every example I can think of has those speed bumps. The transitions are often difficult. Some are more difficult than others from what I see, but there's always pain points. I think it's reasonable to assume that a large percentage of the jobs that exist today will not exist 10 years from now. I think that's a very, very safe assumption. We don't even have to go far back to see a pattern or a precedent for this, right? I mean, in the 80s and the 90s, the personal computer came online in my industry. And I was a kid for this, but I saw it. And I certainly know plenty of people who kind of lived through it as professionals who are a little bit older than I am. That machine eliminated the way graphic design was done. You know, there were no more typesetters and line of all the tools that we used to hand build advertisements and marketing materials and stationery, all these standard things, right? They were done by computer. And there were plenty of really good and famous designers who said, this is a flash in the pan. We're not learning this. This is going to go away. We hate this thing. And they went away. Those people did not stay in the field. They were eliminated. And it were the people who had the foresight to realize, like, this is forever going to change what we do, that got on board and who were the next generation of really successful designers. And I think, you know, that's a really great example of a easy speed bump to predict, that many, many, many of the jobs that we are doing right now are soon going to be done through automation, through AI, generative AI, or whatever it may be. That said, I think there are more jobs on the other side of the computer revolution than there were before it. We have social media experts, all kinds of digital metrics people. What you do, SEO, wasn't even conceivable in the 80s and 90s, right? And so I think, you know, as painful as it will be as those jobs get eliminated, I think there will be more opportunity, more general wealth and plenty to do on the other side of this than there is now. And that's exciting to me.
Yeah. And I think that's what's hard to imagine, right? I just actually got done with another conversation, you know, talking about optimism versus pessimism. And, you know, the thing about optimism is that in order to see the optimistic, it requires change.
Yep.
Right. And it's hard to visualize, like, oh, all the jobs we have now, bookkeeping, clerical, even law jobs, some marketing, copywriting, design, like a lot of those, yes, can be taken over by computers. But then it's hard to imagine, as you said, the jobs that, you know, people have today, data analytics and all of this that didn't even exist right prior to the computer, certainly prior, it existed in a limited sense prior to the internet. And so that's a big change, right? So one of the, and with AI in particular, probably one of, playing devil's advocate here, right? One of the pushbacks is, you know, I think Sir John Templeton says, like, the four most dangerous words in investing are, this time it's different. Unless, of course, it really is different. So if you know, you say, okay, AI, now the machines, right, are thinking and doing more of this. Is it different this time? Yay or nay, and what makes you think it is or is not, right?
I think there are aspects that are different, but largely no, right? I mean, if you go back and you read some of the things that were being written at the invention of the printing press, at the advent of the personal computer during industrialization, even things like weaving looms, right, the Luddites, there's always this mix of like excitement and, you know, people were really afraid of what this might mean. I mean, you can actually read about the invention of the fork and Europeans being resistant to that idea because God gave you perfectly good hands. This is an affront to him, right? So there's always resistance. And then in hindsight, it always looks quaint. We always like, that's so ridiculous. The fork, like, come on. And so I think 10, 20 years from now, we're going to look back on this and we're going to read some of the things that have been written about how AI is going to just ruin everything. And it's the worst thing that ever happened, that this time it was different. And we're going to look back and think that was so silly, because we're just going to have to adapt. There's no way around it. And we will. I think what makes it different this time, one of the main things anyway, is that these technological paradigm shifts are happening closer together than ever before. I mean, it was 500 years from the printing press to any kind of a digital computer in the mid 20th century. Nobody lived through that paradigm shift to see the next. Whereas we're getting really used to the idea of major disruptions that affect every aspect of our life, because, you know, the personal computer was only 40, 30 years ago. The internet was only really 20 years ago, 25, 30 years ago, right? And so we have people all over planet Earth who have lived through multiple paradigm shifts. And so that actually makes me even a little more optimistic, because people are thinking about and have experience with the possible negative side of this and how can we mitigate that a little bit. And so, you know, a lot of these paradigm shifts have resulted in widespread, very, very violent conflict. Whereas maybe this time around, there's enough of them back to back. And these tools also really have helped us study history and understand it more deeply. Maybe we can avoid some of that this time. So generally speaking, I'm really pretty optimistic as a whole.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So you have one foot firmly planted in academia, right? You're a professor. Mm-hmm. And I
not too firmly. I'm a graphic designer. I don't have a PhD in philosophy or something like that.
Sure,
they
sure,
let
sure.
us into the club, but we are on.
But you still exist in that world, right? Like,
yeah,
training,
yeah,
people for jobs for a world that exists right now, but frankly, based, you know, on this conversation, what we're seeing may not exist in the future.
Right.
So how do you, you know, if you are either mid-career, maybe even late career, but especially if you're young, and I think the onus of this conversation was a post I made on LinkedIn about a high school kid I know who, you know, his teachers are like, you can't use ChatGPT for anything. Like, don't use it. If we catch you, it's plagiarism, yada, yada. And so to me, that was a big red flag, because I'm like, this thing is moving so fast. Like, I want my kids to be fluent in ChatGPT prompts, right? And whatever is the next iteration of that. So for you as somebody in academia, how are you thinking about this? Like, what are you putting in place? How do we bring that in? Because academia is often 5-10 years or more behind the curve. So how are you thinking about using this in classes, and what should people, both in academia and just in life, like, how do you keep up with this sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really fortunate. I tell people I have two dream jobs, that I own a business, and, you know, we were actually working on branding AI projects as long as 7 years ago. So before ChatGTP really made it a household conversation. And so I think that's given me an advantage. Like, I got to kind of see the potential impact of this in a more business setting, you know, a number of years ago.
Sure.
And just, you know, our job as brand developers is to be the translator, to take this really abstract, kind of hard to understand thing and talk about it in simple terms. So, you know, that's kind of a unique thing for me. As a professor, it's interesting to talk with colleagues about this. Some of them are, few of them are, I have to be honest, are excited about this. Most of them seem very kind of, I don't want to say scared, but very cautious about this. They have deep concerns, and that's reasonable, right? I think, you know, it's part of the human condition to fear the unknown. And this is certainly that, right? We don't know what this looks like we can never predict the future. And this one has a lot of potential to do good and bad.
Yeah. I think even the people building it, right? Like don't yet. Yeah. I don't think anybody does, right? Understand all the implications of it.
Right. For sure. No. And we never have. And I'm maybe a little bit overly optimistic about it. I'm really gung ho. And so, my position, having experienced this when I was in an undergrad setting as a student with the internet, I mean, I had professors that told us we weren't allowed to use the internet to write a paper. And that's just so unthinkable now. And I really truly believe it's going to be the same with AI. So, I have these conversations with colleagues and it's a mixed bag, but for the ones that are hesitant, I'm a strong advocate for not only just thinking about, a lot of the conversation is about how do we prevent our students from using this to plagiarize? And I don't think that's reasonable. And I don't think that's helpful. I encourage my students to use AI to write papers. And I try to show them different techniques to go about that. And I try to explain them too, that like ChatGTP is not a fantastic author. It just isn't. It's a wonderful writing assistant.
Not yet. Yeah.
Hire an editor or a copy editor or a proofreader or any of that. Like I can use ChatGTP to do a lot of my day-to-day stuff. It can be a rights issue too. Like any student who has dyslexia, which I suffer from a little bit, like this is a huge tool to help me overcome something that's really held me back most of my life. And I'm so excited about that aspect of it. And so I really try to think about the assignments that I've given over the years and how do I need to upgrade them now? How do I have to continue to do my job well in the world we live in today, not the one that I learned 20 years ago, and think about my assignments differently. If a student can easily hop on Google and get the answers to my test questions or use AI to write a paper assignment that I've given, it's that assignment is not helping my students anymore. This is a new world. Those challenges are not realistic challenges for their day-to-day life 5 and 10 years from now. And so I'm trying to actively seek out people who are thinking about this, talking about this, experimenting with this, both in the classroom and in industry, and try to incorporate new ways of thinking about these old problems as far as getting students to really learn about something in a way that they can speak about it and design about it in a thoughtful and knowledgeable way, and not just get a quick answer from an AI. I don't know.
Yeah.
That kind of answers the question.
It does. So help me though, put some flesh to those bones, if you will, of like, what does this actually look like? What are the examples of, cause I think, going back to my college days, okay, write a paper about, the history of Apple computer, right? Okay. That's a easy ChatGPT spits out a bunch of stuff, key dates, things like that. Mm-hmm. How are you, specifically in writing? Cause that's what I know. So I think this is a good place to dive in. And that's what many people are familiar with ChatGPT. How are you structuring then your prompts, your quizzes, your papers, like to take advantage of that and not just have a copy paste, single prompt line paper? Like, what are you doing differently now that this exists and is becoming ubiquitous?
Yeah, I think in the paper setting, and I'm a studio professor, most of my projects are projects, they have to make something, some kind of artwork, design work. But I do teach that history class and I do have them write research papers. And the easiest solution is just make the papers harder. Don't just regurgitate to me the history of this particular typeface designer or its impact in this particular genre, right? In the 1500s or 1700s, whatever it may be. They can use it to find that stuff really quick and easily. And now I have to go a step further and ask them to start to synthesize, all right, how and why would you use that today in an appropriate manner that is relevant to this subject matter, right? And that's what we do as designers anyway. We appropriate aesthetic from the past in order to communicate certain values about a product or presidential candidate, whatever we're promoting with our design work, right? And so my papers just get harder and it's rewarding for me. I try to persuade my colleagues a little bit. I'm like, I'm not correcting spelling mistakes and grammar errors in papers anymore. I'm learning from my students, which is so exciting for me. The papers I'm getting back are so much better. And I know that it's more than a copy paste. It's more than they did a prompt and AI spit back a paper for my students, because the conversations we're having in the classroom are so much better. They have such a deeper understanding of the material and how to apply it now than what we could get to in the past, because there was so much time tracking down and getting through the content to find those important things that they're going to apply. I mean, in my own research, I am able to just develop much richer and complex ideas for the classroom, for my clients, because I don't have to spend a week reading a book to extract the things that I need from it. Now, I still read a lot, and I don't want people to hear that and think like, oh, well, you know, we're going to eliminate reading or something, because I hear that. It just lets me get to the books that I need to read. And there's other AI tools too, like Speechify is one of my favorite things ever invented, because I can get through so much more literature with that aid than I could sitting down with a paperback day in and day out. So it speeds up and deepens my students' understanding, my own understanding. And I just feel like we're able to get through the tedious part of research much more quicker. And I don't even know that that is a big difference from how it has been done for centuries, right? I mean, people who write have research assistants. They have human beings doing this tedious work for them so they can get to those answers quickly. And we've just democratized that. We've created an AI that can do a lot of the work that would be very, very expensive for a student in college to do. And I'm excited for a whole new generation of scholars who have the resources that very few people have had throughout the centuries.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's a lot there to unpack. So how you're seeing it, I want to repeat back to you to make sure I understand. You're seeing it more as like a writing assistant, right?
Research assistant, writing assistant, visual development assistant. I mean, I work with a handful of artists as well who are you know, very, you know, widely known, recognized, really accomplished artists who use AI to iterate and get a lot of ideas down quickly and then take that and develop it into, you know, a final piece. Whereas, you know, very famous artists of the 20th century had whole teams of people doing this for them, and then they would sign it when they were done. I mean, even centuries earlier. So yeah, I'm excited to just put these tools in the hands of more and more people. I mean, those individuals are going to have such an advantage in life that you had to be wealthy centuries past to have. Now it's for everybody. And also
that's interesting, right? Like before you'd need employees or a team right, to do the stuff that you can do now in 20, 30 minutes on, you know, ChatGPT. And I think from a business standpoint, like a lot of this, what I'm seeing in some companies, obviously there's going to be a huge job impact, but it's also getting rid of stuff that maybe was outsourced to like virtual assistants or, you know, like jobs that, you know, in some ways, perhaps the jobs in India and, you know, Pakistan and some of these are going to be even more impacted than what we see in the US. Certainly there will be impact there. But it's going to be the, you know, wash, rinse and repeat sort of jobs, data entry, tasks, data analysis, rather than the deep, I guess, thinking, right? The other thing when you were talking that came to mind, Joe, is like, I don't know if this is a right analogy, but, you know, sort of the bell curve analogy, right? Of like, now the papers are either going to be really good or ChatGPT, like, you know, direct. Like there's a, kind of that middle of the road. And it seems like, I don't know, maybe there's almost like we're bifurcating, right? Of like, you're either just going to copy and paste it into ChatGPT or it's really going to force you to work harder to get to the nuggets of truth, right? Or the concepts and really refine those. Cause I see people using it both ways, right? I see the copy paste, churn and burn, like here's a prompt. It needs to be 700 words or 1,000 words or whatever, go. Right. But then, yeah, to your point, being able to use it, as a sparring partner, right? So to speak of like, hey, here's some ideas. Like, how do I sort this out? Right.
Yeah. And that's going to get more difficult as time goes on. Right. I mean, AI is never going to be more primitive than it is right this moment. This is only getting better, and it's going to get better quickly. So, yeah, I mean, there will come a day when a student can just give a simple prompt or just copy paste my assignment, and then ChatGPT is going to write a far better paper than I could, right? I mean, that's right around the corner. So I don't know exactly what that looks like. I don't know that that's necessarily new either. I think tools have always done a better job than we have on the other side of their invention eventually. I could kind of joke about too, like there are AI grading tools that have been around for a while now that do a really good qualitative job of grading, you know, long format content, not just multiple choice. And so then, you know, it's kind of a comical thing to imagine, but you know, the students are using AI to write the papers and the teachers are using AI to grade them and nobody's actually read any of them. What does that mean for us? I don't know.
Yeah, it's like an AI arms race between students right. and teachers. What a crazy
Yeah, and it will be an arms race for sure. It is an arms race, right? Between countries, between academics and students. It's going to be that. But when it starts to happen, nobody's reading the content. That's kind of funny to me and interesting. But I think there's always going to be human beings who are really interested and use it as a tool. And there's always going to be human beings who are looking for an easy solution and don't want to actually be enriched from it and learn from it or work. I think we've always had that though. So I'm not sure if that's a whole lot different than previous examples.
So makes sense. What else are you doing to sort of equip folks for this, right? Like as you think about, you know, the students that you're going to graduate who, you know, have spent, you know, thousands of hours trying to learn Photoshop or whatever, mm-hmm. right? Like to write, copyright, whatever the action step is. How are you equipping for this future? And what would you be looking at either for your own kids, for your students? Like, how are you thinking about it?
Yeah, I mean, two things that I've always encouraged my students to do, you know, long before AI was really on the map the way we've seen it in recent years, has been to one, know that the jobs that they are going to have probably don't exist yet, right? I mean, that is a given in my mind. When you become a student at a college or a freshman, I would bet my bottom dollar that 10 years from now, you're going to be doing some job that doesn't exist yet. That was the case for you and me, for past generations. Like the tech is moving in every arena so fast that's a pretty predictable trend. And so I try to encourage them to not just learn really redundant tasks, but to be critical thinkers. And I really strongly encourage them to never just learn how to do a trick and do that over and over again. Gone are the days where you can learn a trick and do it for 50 years until you retire. You have to be a critical thinker. If you want to stay relevant, you have to be able to adapt because change is the constant now. The other thing that I really strongly encourage students to do is to embrace technological change. And it's funny to see this shift. I used to show a documentary, it's a little bit dated now, but it's called Transcendent Man. It's on Ray Kurzweil and the transhumanist movement. And I'm not a transhumanist by any stretch of the imagination, but I think they have some really interesting observations. And the students I showed this to 10 years ago were horrified by the prospect of some of the technological advances like AI and robotics, genetics, all kinds of stuff that it touches on. And after a while, like it doesn't faze them anymore. They're growing up with this stuff. They are much more comfortable with the idea of technological change. But the AI one has been a curveball. A lot of the students that I talk to are afraid of it. They think it's the end of the world. And maybe it's the media hype, right? I mean, you see a lot of those headlines. There's a lot of kind of fear of what's coming next and what this could mean for humanity. And so maybe that's part of it. But I really try to strongly encourage them, use these tools, be familiar with them. Like the second that you find yourself saying, that's dumb, I'm not going to learn that, you're done. It's just over. You have to embrace that change. You have to learn the new trick or you're going to be in trouble.
Sure. It makes sense. You know, predicting the future is always dangerous, but as you think about your industry design, right, over the next year, couple of years, I mean, I think at the beginning of the call, I can't remember if it was when we talked before or during the podcast, but we talked about how, you know, the job of a designer as we envision it right now, Photoshop, click and drag, all this won't really exist. Right. What do you think that's going to look like? And again, this is pure speculation. You don't know, sure. And I don't know, but like somebody who's at least, you know, toward the cutting edge of this, you know, early adopter, what does design look like in 5-10 years or specifically the job of a designer?
Right. Oh, what does that look like? I'm not really sure. I know it doesn't look anything like it does right now. That I'm sure of. It's funny because I used to tell students 5+ years ago that design was such a great career path because it's very, very cultural. it's hard to send overseas because unless you're embedded in the culture, it's very hard to communicate. Like you just, I mean, colors mean different things in different parts of the world. Type has such a rich history that is really unique to the subject matter and can have a huge impact on how things are understood. And, you know, you can't send that overseas to somebody who's not embedded in the culture. It's really tough to do. I used to say that AI is really great at automated tasks, but it's very, like, one of the last things it's going to figure out is creativity. Man, was I wrong about that. I was really, really wrong about that. It's not quite there yet, but it is very clearly getting there quickly. And so I think moving forward, we need to, you know, for designers, I think it's going to be really, really important to have a deeper understanding about what things mean and why. I think the humanities are going to become more and more important. Those more complex and emotionally intuitive disciplines are going to be the things that are sought after. And being really good at Photoshop and cleaning up this image or generating this idea, that part's probably going to start to wane. And I think a lot of the production jobs, just the grunt work of being a designer and making a lot of things for ads and pumping out ideas, that's going to go so much more quickly with much fewer hands. So it, you know, I think our field will probably shrink considerably in that regard. And I think, you know, that higher level thinking about design, the skill set that we typically reserve for creative directors and the thought leadership people, those are going to become essential. That's my kind of forecast right now.
Yeah. Well, and that, there's a whole thread we could pull on too about like, is AI being creative, right? Or is it just effectively copying and pasting? And I think right now, certainly it's generative AI, but it's a lot more in the copy pasting, you know, like it learns, sees a bunch. Well, talk to me about that, right? Because like, how do you see it from as, you know, as far as like inputs and outputs?
So it's funny. One of my roles at the college I teach at is I oversee our core program where we have certain literacies that we focus on as a college that we want to foster in our students. And I'm the creative literacy mentor. And I had to give a presentation on the history of creativity. And it's really interesting to go through the ages, you know, from first century ideas about creativity, the Greek thought on it, moving through medieval thought and some of the Christian thought on it into today. And, you know, postmodernism, late 20th century thought on creativity is that it's primarily taking past ideas, putting them together in new ways to generate new ideas. And that is exactly what AI does. And it does it really, really well. And so if you have a romantic notion, I mean, that very in the historical sense, a romantic period, kind of enlightenment period philosophy about creativity, that it just is this wellspring from the individual. It's kind of mystical and magical. And it's who I am and what I do as an artist. And I make this creative stuff. Then yeah, AI doesn't do that. But I could make a very strong argument that human beings don't either. The most creative people in my field are really knowledgeable about history. And they're very good at studying patterns and trends in different industries to understand how to combine things differently to communicate more effectively. It's very kind of mathematically or statistically driven. And I'll just use a quick example of that. Like if somebody says that's very Swiss design, or that's very kind of late this movement or whatever, that's a mathematical statement. What I'm saying is we see a lot of these combinations of elements in this geographic location called Switzerland during this period of time in history called the 1950s, right? It's clumsy math. It's a gross estimation, but it's statistically driven, and AI is very good at that. And so I think with the right prompts and the right structuring of how those prompts are interpreted by AIs and how those outputs are kind of calculated, AI can do what we do much better than we're doing it right now. So I do think AI can be very, very creative.
Okay, but it's the creative in that it's mathematically emulating, you know, what has been done before in a sense, which again is, as you say, I think astutely, that is, if not everything, a lot of what a typical designer, a typical creative, right, in whatever field you are, does anyway, right? You know, great artists, good artists borrow, great artists steal, right? And that's what AI effectively is doing very quickly and rapidly, right, with sort of a mathematical layer on top of it.
Yeah, and this could get, I don't know what the word is esoteric or maybe metaphysical even, but then, you know, this very quickly turns into a debate about, okay, this is how machines are doing it, but how do humans really do it? Are we
sure
kind of creative spirits, or are we just kind of mechanical mush that is punching numbers in our brains and really doing what computers are doing exactly the same as this materialist or something different? So that probably is a little off topic, but I mean, there's a very good case to be made that the way we do it is exactly how AI is doing it. And it has always been that way. It's kind of mimetic in that sense.
Right. And that's what my understanding, again, I'm not a neural net expert or anything, but that's
me either.
It was designed, right, to emulate in some cases, you know, the human, yeah, human brain, right? Within reason. And somebody, I'm sure, more technical could explain a lot better than you or I can. Okay, so back to kind of the big optimistic thing, right? So if you are somebody who's young in your career, right, and you're thinking about this, like, you know, optimistic for humanity is one thing, optimistic individually might be another, right? And so we talked about maybe how to prepare and how to embrace it, but like, yeah, just talk through that. Somebody who's like, you know, I'm really nervous about the future for me as an individual, and everyone's case is different. So this is a big, broad statement. I understand that. But like, yeah, what would you say to that person? How do you make the individual optimistic case? Whether it's through action or, yeah, where do you take that?
Yeah, it's definitely scary because it's the unknown. And I think everybody fundamentally is kind of terrified of the unknown for the most part. That's been my experience, and I am too. But I tried very hard to be optimistic and to look at things a little more rationally than emotionally. And I encourage students to, you know, look at the changes that are coming, prepare for the worst, the best that you can, the way you can kind of size up what seems to be on the horizon here, but don't get caught up in sensational headlines about, you know, AI is going to be the end of the world. I think there could be a lot of road bumps, but I do think, I'm going to say long-term, but I don't think it's that long. You know, 5-10 years from now, there's so many opportunities that are going to present themselves that are going to be available to these people coming out of college that aren't there now. Right? And I just, the trajectory of the human experience. I mean, when I was a kid, we heard about world hunger all the time. I remember hearing crazy stats, and I don't know how accurate they are, but like 70% of the world went to bed hungry at night, and that's just not what it is anymore. Sure. And technology has largely been one of the most contributing factors to that not being reality for most people. And so I'm really optimistic despite all the sensational news that is out there. I think, you know, the human experience has only gotten better in however many thousands of years we've been on this planet. And I think there's every reason to believe it's going to continue to get better. Not that it's a straight line or curve up. It's going to have its ups and downs, but over the course of a lifespan, I expect my students to have a much better world to live in when they're in their 30s, 40s, 60s, 80s than my parents had, or that even you and I will have. It's just getting better. And if they can kind of see that pattern across history, I mean, I just remember getting dental work done in the 80s and 90s, and it's just so much less painful now. It's just so much less painful. And students laugh at that, but I think it's a great, simple example of just how things are improving and they will continue to improve.
Yeah. So, again, a lot of threads we could pull on, and maybe this isn't, feel free to pass on this question, right? If you don't feel comfortable, but as far as like, you know, heading, we're recording this in March of 2024, right? And this moves so fast, I figure we should at least date it. Right. You know, as far as, misinformation, disinformation, fake news, whatever, you know, the title you want to put on it, like how is this going to play a part, and how are you, seeing that people will learn to navigate in that world, right? Because I think now there's obviously, you can't, you know, people say you can't trust everything you read on the internet, which is certainly true. But as you know, the ability to make anybody say anything, right, becomes viable, at least on a video perspective, right? Like, how do you think we'll manage the next few years of this potential chaos?
I think we'll manage it poorly, to be honest. I think we'll manage it poorly. That said, this too is not unprecedented, right? We have this horrible kind of general perception of video or photography as being an objective representation of reality. It is not. It is media. It is written down in ones and zeros on strips of tape and on hard drives, and it exists in a written format somewhere. And until the mid-19th century, everything we knew was for the most part written or drawn, right? Photography, 1850s, give or take. And we came up with ways of verifying what was true. For hundreds and for thousands of years, people figured out ways to authenticate information and figure out somebody wrote this down and said that they were so-and-so. We were able to check handwriting. We were able to just verify events. We have always found ways to verify media's accuracy and truth. And it's really not until photography shows up that there's just this ubiquitous idea that, oh, there's a photograph that must have happened. But in the earliest examples of photography, things were being manipulated and used to deceive. And that is the history of photography and video. And so I think, you know, we're going to have to lose that illusion very, very quickly. I don't think that's going to happen. Maybe it will. I mean, with deepfakes and everything else, I think it would be healthy if people questioned everything that they saw on a screen. And I talk about this with my students quite a bit. I tell them, even your backup camera on your car, you're not looking behind your car. It is a representation of what is behind your car. And somebody could very easily print out a photograph and stick it over that camera to trick you into having a fender bender. Like, that is a plausible reality that we live in. And I think as this progresses, especially the deepfake stuff, the AI video, it's fascinating to me, and it's wild how much it's gone, how much it's kind of advanced in just 1 year's time. I think we're going to really quickly have to lose that idea that, you know, just because we have a video or a photograph of it, that it is, that's truth. And I think we will come up with ways to continue to kind of test the media that gets put in front of us.
I like that, because I hadn't thought about it, you know, that photographs and video particularly are fairly recent, you know, past 100 years. And before that, it was written text. And before that, just verbal, right? Like, you know, me telling you a story, you telling me a story, which of course is probably the easiest format to make, at least at the time, right? To make anything up. And I could say that Joe told me this, and in fact, he never told me this, or whatever. Right. And so really, we almost had this window of 100 years, you know, maybe a couple hundred years, maybe 50 years, depending on video versus, you know, photography, how you want to define that, where those could be trusted, you know, air quotes. But now we're losing that, but it's not a unique position for humanity to be in, right? And I think, to me, I hadn't thought deeply about like the fact that, you know, it was only unique because it's just been unique for this one little period of time until, you know, we can innovate. But then we're just going back to like, where did it come from? You know, is it a trustworthy source? Like, you know, does it add up with the other facts that I, you know, and all the other questions that need to be asked typically of when you hear anything, whether it's a rumor or a written word or anything like that. Now video is just the same, and we lower its general credibility and now have to be more engaging or more astute, right, with the way that we approach it. I think that's a really good point that I hadn't thought about.
Yeah, and I'm kind of a wannabe history nerd, right? I get to teach this class, and I've learned a lot doing that over the years. But a lot of these quote unquote new challenges that AI present are not new at all. If you look back over the course of history, these are things that humanity has faced again and again and again. And there are solutions that have been used that are probably pretty appropriate in this new world. And there's just lots of good lessons to be learned. And I think the big difference, you know, going back to a point we touched on earlier, is that we're seeing these paradigm shifts happen multiple times over the course of a lifetime. So I feel like for the first time, we are learning from history because we're living through history in a much more eventful way than people 500 years ago did, right? And so we are learning from history, and hopefully we'll avoid some of the pitfalls that have happened so many times because we've seen them two or three times just in, you know, 20, 30 years. So that makes me even more optimistic.
Totally. So let's close with a couple of things, because I want to be respectful of your time. So first question I'm going to ask is around like more examples, because I think examples stick with people of times where, you know, you just said that we have faced these similar challenges and overcame them. So I'd love to dive into however many, 1, 2, 5, however many you kind of got there. And then at the very end, I do want to talk tools, right? So as of, you know, March, 2024, that part's not going to be evergreen, it's going to be dated. But like, if somebody's like, okay, you convinced me there's an optimistic case, I want to dive in, what are those tools? So, but first I want to really dive into like, you know, we talked about the Reformation, we talked about the printing press. Where else have we seen this?
It's funny. It goes back to the very beginning. I mean, you can read some of Plato's dialogues, and it touches on a story of King Thamos in Egypt arguing with Thot about the benefit of writing to humanity. And Thamos would argue that it's not really going to make people wiser. It's just going to give them artificial access to information and the illusion of wisdom. And so right back, I mean, writing and language itself is a technological advancement, right? And so this argument goes back to the dawn of time, really, to recorded history. The printing press is probably, I think, one of the clearest examples. But in the 1600s, the fork became popular in Europe, and I think St. James is kind of credited with saying that this is an affront to God, that people were given perfectly good hands for reading with. That's not verifiable. It's probably not true, but there's plenty written about kind of backlash against the fork, and we think that's silly now. In the 1800s, you can find stories about religious groups saying that going faster than a certain mile per hour, typically I've heard 11 miles per hour is a sin, and we shouldn't be doing that. That also is probably apocryphal and not completely accurate, but you can find plenty of things written about steam power and steam engines, and that this is kind of scary, right? This is going to be a huge paradigm shift. So there's always this backlash. A lot of us live through computers. I remember being in grade school. I went to Catholic school growing up, and the priest who oversaw the school said that the computer was going to be a flash in the pan. And we had all this grant money to get computers for students, and he got rid of them all. And it was like, it was an outrage. Wow. And man, yeah. I was on the wrong side of history, right? So the backlash is universal. And I think it's always that fear of the unknown. But I mean, if you look back, I'm really glad we have forks. You know, that's a really advantage to me and just hygiene in general, and probably has saved countless lives in terms of hygiene. You know, the steam engine is one I talk about in the classroom a lot because it changed so much about design. Design got faster. There were industrial presses, all kinds of typographic development that came about. We went from metal type that was very, very small to woodblock type of posters. We had packaged goods. I mean, it's really the birth of graphic design as a profession that came out of a faster pace of life that came about because of steam power. And so that's really fun and interesting to talk about, and just the aesthetic artifacts that were left behind that now people kind of associate with the wanted poster motif or something like that. But like all that is tied up in the mystique of the Wild West and expansionism and US policy during that time. And it's always driven by technology. And so, you know, we could have another 10 episodes on kind of the history of design and why things look the way they do. And 9 times out of 10, it's because of technological advancements, either directly or indirectly. And so, you know, I can't think of an advancement in the history of us, right, that has not long term resulted in a better life for people.
You know, you can argue, the jobs, if I can hop on again, not a historian, but on the jobs front, right, you think about like even the invention of the iPhone, how many jobs that created. Suddenly you had, you know, app developers, you had you know, cases, charger, I mean, like all the thing, you know, Bluetooth syncing and all the technology behind that, like, you know, jobs like influencers, right? You know, all these things that didn't exist right before the iPhone came. And you're like, yeah, there's somebody who's gonna, you know, have a little device called a telephone that records video, and then they're gonna post it, and millions of other people are gonna watch it on their phone, and they're gonna sell products that way. Like, was so foreign. Or like, you're gonna build software, but it's gonna live on a microcomputer in your pocket. Like, to us, that is so obvious, but it's it was so foreign, right? And is so foreign, or was so foreign for so many people, you know, for a lifetime. Like, you can't imagine in the 70s being like, yeah, we'll have a microcomputer. You know, that was like, you were, you know, it was Star Trek stuff, really.
Yeah, exactly. It's totally Star Trek. And I can get nostalgic too, right? I drove across the country twice without a cell phone when I was in my younger, you know, early 20s. My kids will never have that kind of freedom. But I wouldn't want them to have that, right? The risk and the danger of just walking around the block without your cell phone is kind of unimaginable to us. But what a great world, right? I mean, I don't have to worry about my kids going around and living their lives as they get older and not having access to emergency care if, God forbid, they needed it. And so, you know, all those aspects come into play. I mean, we're losing certain things. I really have fond memories of that experience. And I know that my children will never have that. But you know, the opportunities, the things that they're going to get to do were unimaginable to me when I was a kid too. It's a little off topic maybe, but I remember when we brought our daughter home about 5 years ago, we went for our first walk around the block and there was a SpaceX launch going up for her first walk. And I looked at my wife and thought about, you know, it was 60 years from Kitty Hawk to a man landing on the moon, walking on the moon. It's really likely that our daughter will recreationally travel to space. That is probable. That is probable. Yeah. I mean, and how cool is that? That's amazing. And people don't think about just the day-to-day stuff. I mean, even older people, they take for granted the cell phone and stuff. People who live most of their lives without those tools. I had a recent health thing that put me up for, you know, a couple of weeks. And I'm able to read books on my injury and figure out what's going on and talk to doctors. I didn't have to go through the agony of being transported to a doctor's office and, you know, the thing that I was dealing with. I had plenty of entertainment. I was able to get some work done. I mean, that would have been unthinkable 20, 30 years ago. Like, you're just going to sit there, maybe lose your job because you couldn't get to work. Sure. And so I'm just so optimistic. There's so many small and soft things of everyday life that we just take for granted now that are just fantastic. And they were Star Trek 30 years ago.
Yeah. Totally. Man, that's good. That's a good place to wrap up that section for sure. Okay. So for somebody who's like, okay, Joe, like I want to be optimistic about this, or I certainly at best don't want to get left behind. Mm-hmm. Right. Like you mentioned, I think Speechify, I mean, ChatGPT is the household one. Like where does somebody, if they're, you know, if they've been resistant, but now they bought in and like, I need to get started. I need to figure this out. Where do you even start with this? Like, what's the best way to get going?
Yeah, I mean, I think ChatGPT is a great resource and it's accessible to people. The free version is fantastic. The paid for one is 10 times more fantastic. I use it quite a bit and I find it really, really helpful. As I mentioned, I have a little bit of dyslexia and it has held me back over the years. So for me, writing, it's a tremendous aid to me. It has saved me a ton of time, money, and has really opened up a lot of opportunities that I've probably been missing out on for a very long time.
Can you talk about that? Like, yeah. What does, you know, what does the prompts look like? Like, how do you do that? Like, how is it helping you?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've always had a hard time writing because I'm very easily distracted and my attention spans tends to be short. Like it really is. I don't know how to explain it. If somebody hasn't really experienced it's so frustrating. But it's a different dynamic. I think the reward mechanism of things like social media and likes and whatnot that can keep anybody engaged far more than we should be are somewhat in play in the format of prompting and getting a response. And so I'm able to take a bunch of jumbled ideas and do a brain dump, and where it would take me hours, if not days, to organize into intelligible prose, I can take that brain dump and chunk it into ChatGPT and get a reasonable collection of paragraphs that are well written. I might have to kind of reprompt it and tell it, you know, tone down the marketing language a little bit, or can you kind of expand on this idea? And it doesn't do the thought work for me. It just takes my really kind of challenging grammar stuff and solves that problem for me. It's like having a writing assistant, really. I mean, and I've worked with people who've helped me write for a long time now, and I'm able to not dictate, but just kind of talk with them and have them take notes and then write something for me. And this does a lot of that. I still use copywriters in my professional work. And I still ask copywriters and editors to look at certain things that I'm working on, but the grunt work that takes hours and hours and hours of me having conversations with someone trying to make sense of my jumbled thought is kind of gone. I'm able to do a lot of that and hand off something much more along the way to that individual for real refinement. So it makes their lives easier. It makes my life easier. So grateful for that.
Can you give again, just a high level example of like, okay, I got a proposal. I got a paper. Here's, you know, how I, various prompts that you throw that in. Again, not like super detailed. I know we can do super prompts and get crazy deep, but like,
yep.
Give an example if you would, just to drive it home for folks.
Okay. So yeah, in a proposal setting, for example, I will have, I use mind maps a lot. And so my brain just works better that way. I'm a visual person, so I can see it. So I'll do a mind map and I use a tool called MindNode, which isn't which is pretty good. You know, you can use whatever, but you know, I just get it all out there, and I have that generate more of a list, right? I can take that mind map, and it will put it into a text format and give it some hierarchy, and then I can prompt chat to say, you know, I have a mind map for this project I'm writing up a proposal for. Here's all my thoughts about the research component. Can you organize that into a bulleted list of things that we will be researching and generate a short description for each one of those bullets? And we'll put that together. And now I have to go through and read that. I will make edits. I might pull out a few of those bullets and ask it to kind of retool that a little bit if it's long enough. But I can ask it to write a little bit of a preamble to that, just kind of framing what that section is about. And I'm able to work my way through all the collateral that we should work on for this project, write a nice conclusion. And when it's done, it's beautiful. And clients are super appreciative. I've been told literally recently, that is the most detailed and clear proposal I've ever received. Thank you. I didn't tell them that I used AI. They sure. may or may not end up listening to this and be like, oh, that's how he did that. You know, and I run that by our copywriters and ask them to proof things to make sure, you know, I'm not missing anything. We do our diligence there, but you know, that kind of proposal was just a daunting task that I would procrastinate on forever and then rush at the end. And it wasn't great, to be honest. And now I kind of look forward to the process. I really enjoy it. And, you know, I'm writing some material that I hope to develop into papers and maybe potentially a book one day. I've wanted to, I wrote my graduate thesis in 2010-ish, and it was just an agonizing process. And I was so passionate about the material, so excited to do it. And the paper came out okay, but it's riddled with spelling errors and all kinds of problems. And I'm really excited to revisit that material now and hopefully develop a book out of it. That was something I've wanted to do a long time, but just never seemed possible given some of the just limitations I have with some of the things I struggle with.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point. Even with a proposal, right? A proposal isn't necessarily, you can make an argument, but it's not a huge value add, right? Like you have, if you're anything like us, you have a lot of conversation with the client, and a proposal is just formalizing a conversation, right? And then giving a price and various deliverables. And, you know, it's a lot of grunt work, and that, yeah, could take 10 hours, right? Or 12, 20 hours, you know, depending on how efficient you are, how clear everything is. And so just forcing that can save 10 hours of time or, you know, 5 hours of time. That can be really helpful. You spend more time doing design work or whatever, you know, the value add that you really do is. And that's where I'm certainly excited, is I think it'll free up a lot of time for us to do whatever that core thing is, which means that for somebody else, maybe proposal writing was their core thing and that might go away. So that's bad for them, you know, at least practically. But it's going to, you know, take a lot of that clerical, the mundane, whatever, however you want to call it, and, you know, make that more automated in the same way that, like, you know, automated email, drip email campaigns, like, you know, heck, running ads, like you put it in there and the machine decides where to show it, right? Like, I think a lot of that will get moved. And so certainly that will mean jobs, but it'll also mean, hopefully we get to spend more time on the things that are real value adds to ourselves, our clients, and society in general. So.
Yeah. And just zooming out on that briefly, like it has made me better at the stuff I wanted to do when I became a designer, right? Because I'm not bogged down and burning out on clerical stuff that used to just eat my time and my bandwidth alive. Like my brain energy is done at the end of writing a proposal for 20 hours. It's just grueling and I don't feel like doing anything. And that has freed me up, and I'm doing better design work than I feel like I've ever done, in part because of that. And that makes me excited. You know, we talked earlier about what's the benefit to the individual. The benefit to the individual is the benefit to the community, to the world, that all of us have the potential now to get freed up from these just mind-numbing, grueling day-to-day things that we have to do to put our energies into much more creative things that are going to benefit everyone. And that is really exciting to me.
Yeah, it's the same as like not growing your own food, right? Like,
right.
You know, as quaint or silly as that sounds, right? Like so many, you know, plumbing, electricity, like, yeah, I do my laundry, right? But I have a washer that does it, right?
Right.
Like that saves me hours of time. And now I can focus on those higher level tasks, which might be clerical in the business, but now we're continually pushing up that curve, right? To the real value add stuff, which I think is really, really cool. So, okay. So back to the kind of closing question. We talked about like ChatGPT. Where else? I mean, what are some of the other tools you're excited about, either on design or just in general, that somebody who wants to dive in should take a look at?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of visual generative tools besides DALL-E and OpenAI. I'm not going to even list them. There's just tons of them, and that's a pretty competitive space with Midjourney going back and forth between what's the best one. So that's exciting, and I encourage my students to use that too. I have them do a project where they make a type specimen book, and I had a student last semester use AI to generate a lot of the imagery, and it is by far the best project. I've been assigning that for 10 years, maybe longer. This is the best submission I've gotten on that assignment in 10
Wow.
years of doing this. It's fantastic. It's fantastic. So I think, if you're an artist or if you are a designer, using those tools, if nothing else, to iterate is going to be powerful. But writing and crafting visuals seems to be like two of the most creative things that humans have always done, and these tools are going to speed that up. I'm really interested, a little nervous, but excited too. Just there's so much being produced already. Like, how much more is going to be produced, and how are you ever going to consume it? And there's all these questions that are really interesting to me. But anything you hear of, use it. Like the Speechify tool was a game changer. I've loved Audible and audiobooks. I used to listen to books on CD and tape, decades ago. And
Sure.
now with Speechify, anything that's a PDF, an email, a web page, whatever, like I am just getting through academic material for my discipline faster than ever before. And I have more time to like relax and not do that at the same time. I'm able to get through that stuff and consume more, or I can consume what I need to, and I can take a break and spend time with my family. So
Yeah.
it's just a win all around for me.
So what are you doing? I mean, you're throwing like just academic papers and stuff in there and just converting it to audible speech, right? Like a
Yeah,
type of an
Speechify
audiobook?
is a it's a reading aid, and so anything you can even take a picture of a paper book, and it will highlight the words as it reads it to you. They have a bunch of AI voices. You can choose one that you like, and they're really pretty good. And so for me, as somebody again who struggles with a little bit of that, we're called a learning disability. I don't even like that term, but
Sure.
I've always read a lot, but sometimes it's a struggle for me to focus. It's weird. It's like the TV is on in the background. I read a whole page, but I didn't consume any of it. I'm much
Sure.
more of an audible learner, so I use
Yeah.
that tool for a long time. And now this new tool, Speechify, that I bought last year, not even a year ago now, for $100 a year, anything I can possibly think of, I can turn into an audible book, and I can listen to it while I'm driving, doing housework, whatever. On the flip side, I have to be conscious and try to make quiet time for myself. It's funny, we even don't even sit in the bathroom and not consume media anymore, right? We're flipping through social
Right.
media. But that's just something I have to be aware of and consciously decide I need quiet time, and I can do that, but yeah, I love it. It's fantastic.
Cool. Well, I'm mutually optimistic, right? I think there will be some speed bumps with, all the AI stuff, but I do think there's a big opportunity there for folks who care and want to learn. And I think kind of ready or not, here it comes. There's a little bit of that as well.
Yeah, it's
So
coming.
any
That's for sure. Opting out is not an option. So you have to.
but so any final thoughts, any questions I should have asked that didn't ask, anything else you wanted to cover before we wrap this, Joe?
No, that was a lot of fun. I don't get an opportunity to talk about this often, with colleagues a little bit, but like I said, there's a lot of resistance there. Even the students have resistance. I think my family and close friends are kind of tired of me beating the drum of pro technology. We didn't even talk about AR and how that's going to change everything too. But no, it was a lot
Yeah.
of fun. Really appreciate the conversation.
Likewise. So cool. We'll throw some stuff in the show notes that'll be relevant. But I think the big takeaway is like if you're in a creative field, right? If your field is design, writing, or involves it, even if it ancillarily involves it, it's worth diving into some of this stuff for sure. So cool. Well, thanks, Joe. We'll chat soon.
Thank you.